Lanier spoke on Wednesday, September 21st, 2005, as part of the Art, Technology, and Culture lecture series. The name of the lecture was Can Soulful Music Survive Digital Epistemology? Jaron Lanier started off his lecture playing this awesome instrument of like reeds tied together vertically. It's an instrument from Laos called a can.
The basic problem is that computer software, as we understand it, has a quality that is best described as brittleness. So something is brittle if it breaks before it bends. Right? And software is like that. You can change one little bit and poof, the whole thing will blow up. So what happens is that as soon as one piece of software starts relying on another piece of software, the software that's relied on really can't change anymore because everything will collapse, and thus you get these layers of standards. And thus you have a different mechanism of cultural legacy than you have with other media. Because with other media, you have a layer of interpretation between whatever the communication is and the legacy. Whereas with computers, the legacy embeds itself, and the thing that causes it to be persistent is the degree of harm that would be caused by the collapse of the Tower of Babel that's been built on top of it. So, in the case of music, I'm going to focus on one example called MIDI, which a good friend of ours invented one day in the 80s. I remember it well. Now, MIDI is the standard language used to communicate what happens with basic musical notes in music everywhere these days. It was a world of musical choices that involved discrete on and off notes, and this kind of Aztec on-off digital sort of a thing, in the sort of most naive sense. The early manifestations of that, I don't think will play well with posterity. Disco came out of it. Our dear friend Roger Lynn had the misfortune to be the guy who invented the digital drum machine out of all that. We love him anyway. Another Berkeley is the great center of music technology inventors. I think we have the highest density of them here in the whole world, so all of these people are kind of locals. It's hip-hop. Because in my opinion, hip-hop works, but the way it works is by working with emotional qualities that are embedded in the MIDI standard. And so I think that the meta voice of the whole hip-hop genre... Can I use a expletive here? In Berkeley, you have a free speech movement. I'm about to use some four-letter words because I'm going to talk about hip-hop. Is everybody okay with that? All right. I'm afraid if you stream this, we're going to get raided or something. Anyway, I want you all to protest on my behalf naked on Sproul Plaza if I get arrested over this, okay? All right, do I have your agreement? All right. So I think the meta voice of the overall genre of hip-hop is saying something like, I'm stuck. I'm stuck in MIDI. Everything's the same every time. Every time I play the sample, the same. It's stuck. I'm not part of life anymore. I'm stuck. And there's like this sort of metaphor of the smallness of the digital world with the frustrations of the artist, who's either frustrated because he's an awkward guy who can't get laid in high school, or because he's a member of an oppressed class in a ghetto, or both. But whatever. The point is, the point is that there's this interesting consilience between the emotion of the artist and the inherent problems, the ideas that are mandatory in a new way because of a particular digital standard we're stuck with. I remember very early on, and I don't know who first said this, it might have been some figure like McLuhan or Ted Nelson or any of a number of people, but I remember at least back into the 60s, people talking about the era of remixing that will come. And in fact, I think even Vannevar Bush made some mention of it in his Memex paper, and if you want to go back even early, Ian Forster and The Machine Stopped implied some of this, this notion of culture blending together and having access to things and having recombination. What I think nobody foresaw is the end of style. Now, this might sound like a radical thing, but here's what I want to point out to you, that we're living in the first time in, certainly since recorded music began, and I think for quite a while longer, that we haven't had major new styles with new generations of kids. So if you look at what an undergraduate at Berkeley is listening to today, it's something that essentially their parents could have listened to, or indeed their grandparents. That rap and hip-hop are old forms. I mean, if you see, what we forget is how fast cultural churn used to be. Like, think about for a second that the distance from big band to the Beatles is bigger than us to Nirvana or something like that. I mean, much bigger. You know, so we usually think of our times as accelerating, but this is, in terms of cultural change, we're decelerating, musical cultural change. The dark hypothesis is that all of this cultural mixing that we get from being able to digitize everything and have instant access to it, Googling music and recombining it in music processors, has the effect of, it has an entropic effect that things mix and blend, lose their identity. Now, I want to approach this actually with a spiritual dimension, if I may.
And it here goes like we're this. Comparing apples and oranges.
Let's say you have two objects, an apple and an orange. They are two distinct objects. And you can, they're old jokes about whether they should share a category or not. If you have two digital, if you have two photographs, one a photograph of an apple and one a photograph of an orange, they become more similar and they belong next to each other in a gallery wall. If you have two digital photographs, one of an apple, one of an orange, now the distinction becomes arbitrary because you can morph between them. Right? And this is sort of modulo Moore's law and modulo the size of the bag of tricks that programmers have come up with up to a given time. But by now, Moore's Law has gone along far enough and we have enough tools that we can certainly morph between two photographs with no problem at all. So now, there's no longer a distinct line between these two things. Now, the interesting question about this is that it's an utterly inevitable function of human nature that somebody will think about that digital image of the apple and the digital image of the orange that are no longer distinct. And they will say, well, what about me? Am I distinct anymore? Or am I just another digital file? And here we enter into the world of, I suppose you might call this spiritual digital semantics, of how using computers changes the way people think about themselves and what anxieties they have about themselves.
This was one of my favorite parts.
The first of these streams of culture is the one that was probably defined initially by Alan Turing. Now, is there anybody here who doesn't know who Alan Turing was? Oh! All right. Turing had an illegal life. He was gay. At a time when homosexuality was explicitly outlawed. Now, what happened is his homosexuality came to light to law enforcement, presented a dilemma, because here you have one of the important intellectuals, a national treasure, a great war hero, who's a criminal for a moral crime, what do you do? So instead of sending him to jail, they put him under an effective house arrest and forced him to endure a bizarre quack treatment that was supposed to make him straight. But at medicine at this time, when it came to sexuality, was really weird. I suspect it might still be. You have to remember that the way we think of ourselves is always governed by metaphors from the technologies we know how to make, because the technologies we know how to make are our only confirmed ways of thinking about the world, right? So the dominant set of metaphors to understand the human being at the time of Turing's incarceration was still the steam engine. He was still coming out of the Jules Verne era of metaphors. He hadn't entered the computer one yet, because he just invented it. Nobody else knew about it yet. So in the Jules Verne world of metaphors, everything's like these pressures and these valves and these pipes and the steam blowing off and all those sorts of things. And so the idea was that if somebody was gay, it must be because they were oversexed. And so if you gave them the opposite sex's hormones, then that would balance them out, so then they wouldn't be gay anymore. So Turing was forced to accept massive injections of female hormones. He developed breasts and other female characteristics and became morbidly depressed. He treated an apple in his lab with cyanide and ate it in order to kill himself in a sort of an anti-Eve ceremony that he invented. He was an extremely romantic, he had an artistic sensibility beneath a nerd surface. So it's an extraordinary death, very little known, and actually one of the things that's shocking to me is how few computer scientists know
and
about
theory
it.
Was that, his theory is that...
I should say the guy who designed it initially and the guy who's in charge of it now are both good friends of mine, so when I make fun of this, it's all in good fun, and it's important not to ever let any of these ideas turn into enmity between people, because we have enough enmity without that, so... I want to say that before I trash the stuff. Some years ago, somebody at Microsoft said, wow, we need to hire some artificial intelligence person to make our stuff more intelligent, so it'll be more along this line to passing the Turing test, because that's what it means to get better. So they hired somebody who'd studied with Marvin Minsky, who was also an important mentor to me, by the way, even though I disagree with him on all his ideas. That doesn't mean he's not a wonderful, brilliant, inspiring guy. So they hired another one of his old students, and he went up to Redmond, and he started adding these AI features, some of which are, well, the paperclip and that sort of stuff. But the interesting thing he did to Word is he made Word, instead of it being a tool that just responded to you, suddenly it started to be like your friend who would get to know you and anticipate your every need. So if you make an indentation and you start to number something, it says, oh, my friend is making an outline. I'll automatically start an outline. And then, of course, as you know, you've entered hell. Because you can never get out. Or, oh, my friend wants to capitalize this. And if, in fact, you didn't, you've entered hell. Now, they've made it a little easier over the years to turn this off. In some of the earlier versions of this stuff, I remember they were saying, well, just turn it off if you don't like it. And I actually had the guy who's in charge of the division try to turn it off on my machine, and after 20 minutes, he couldn't do it. So they kidded themselves about it. But anyway, so why were these features there? Well, because they're trying to pass the Turing test. But what's actually happening is anybody who learns to use the tool with these features present is bending over backwards and making themselves into an idiot to make the computer look smart. What this is an alternative idea, and the idea is that over time, over deep time, the variety and richness of connections between people is increasing through a combination of technology and other aspects of culture. And so in the McLuhan ramp, if you go back into deep time, what you see is things like the invention of language, and then you start to see media technologies, and then as you go into the future, you start ending up
So this has been a lecture from the ATC lecture series.